I want to welcome you all very warmly to this panel hosted by the LSE Centre for the Study of Human Rights. I am Stephanie Grant. I'm a visiting fellow at the centre, and I have to start with some practical and housekeeping things. The first of which is to say that we're being podcast, and that means that please would people turn off their mobile phones, not silence them, but turn them off, because if their mobile phones stay on, it can interfere with the podcast. Equally, I'm asked to say, please don't take any photographs of materials on the screen, though I think actually all the materials on the screen are in the public domain, so I think that may not apply here. You're encouraged to tweet on Twitter, hashtag LSE migrant deaths.
How do we do that with our phones?
Phones on.
Good point.
Phones on silent. It's a tweet.
I thought it said you couldn't have it on silent.
No, phones on silent's fine.
Oh, all right. Yeah. Phones are silent. All right, on silent. I also have to draw your attention to the LSE Code of Practice to protect the right of free speech within the law. We will be running as a podcast until just after 7:30. Then the podcast will end, but we can continue with the discussion if we would like to. And finally, a sad thing, Claire Moon is not able to be with us, so she's asked me to give her paper, which I'm very happy to do. The purpose of this panel is to discuss migrant deaths, and specifically migrant deaths at European borders, as a human rights issue. It has seldom, if ever, been done in an academic setting before. And just to, as it were, remind us, in the Mediterranean alone, more than 5,000 deaths were recorded in 2016. Those deaths are unusual because they were counted. Many more migrants and refugees who were not counted or accounted for died or went missing at closed borders in other regions of the world. The Mexico-US border, the Gulf of Aden in the Middle East, the Bay of Bengal and the Andaman Sea in Southeast Asia, the Sahara Desert in North Africa. In these situations, few bodies are identified and most families know absolutely nothing about the fate of missing relatives. Governmental systems seldom, really if ever, record an account for these deaths, which is a great contrast to humanitarian disasters and transportation accidents like, for instance, ships which sink or scheduled airlines. Our speakers will explore the issues from three perspectives. First, the facts. And Anne Singleton will speak about research which has recently been done on missing migrants in the Mediterranean. Professor Shabas will talk about the norms of international human rights law and the duties of states to identify the dead and the rights of families to know. And Claire Moon has written a paper on the question, the difficult question, of whether the dead have rights. Just briefly to give you some biographical detail about our speakers. Anne Singleton is a senior research fellow in Bristol University's School for Policy Studies. Her work focuses on the use of international migration data in the development of policy. She has advised a wide range of European Union institutions and worked with international organisations, including UNHCR and NGOs. She currently advises IOM's, in the International Organization of Migration's Global Migration Data Analysis Center in Berlin, though I think you're not representing them, are you? She will speak about a research project on missing migrants in Italy and Greece and the situation of families in Tunisia and Turkey. And this project was a collaboration between York and City Universities and IOM and was funded by the Economic, Social and Social Research Council. Professor Shabas is Professor of International Law at Middlesex University. He is a very leading international authority on human rights law, international humanitarian law, and international criminal law, and I think that's only for starters. He's written extensively in all these areas, with a special focus on the abolition of the death penalty. He was an international member of the Sierra Leone Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and one of his current research interests is the treatment of the dead as a human rights issue. Claire Moon is an associate professor in the Department of Sociology. She's published widely on issues related to atrocities for a number of years, including transitional justice, victim reparations, war trauma, humanitarianism, human rights reporting, and the forensic investigation of mass graves. She's just been awarded a Wellcome Trust grant to pursue her research on forensics, specifically the case of Mexico and the issue of the human rights of the dead. We're very lucky because it is really an excellent panel to start an academic discussion. Anne, can I invite you to open?
So I've been introduced as somebody who's going to tell you the facts, but as we know, the facts are social constructs, and we're especially no more than in this field than any other, especially when we're dealing with the issue of migration and deaths. From a Eurocentric lens, the way in which the data are collected and reported are very much in a racialised milieu of the lens of scrutiny being on the victims of the policies of the European Union, of all the failures of policy, and perhaps the successes where the policies were intended to have these effects. So I have a very, very dim view of the quality of the information that I'm about to give you, but what I can say is that this is the best we know. This is the best we've been able to collect. And the work that I've been doing with the IOM's Global Migration Data Analysis Centre represents one of the most systematic global attempts to collect data on deaths. I'll be involved this year with co-editing Fatal Journeys 3, which will be the third report on global deaths of migrants. That we expect to come out in August. It will be the third time, so the first time that an attempt was made to collect data at a global level was actually 2 years ago. Just this last Friday, we at the IOM JIMDAC Centre in Berlin, we published this data briefing, which did an analysis of migrant deaths and disappearances worldwide for the last year, 2016. And what we found was that there was a 27% increase in recorded migrant deaths worldwide compared to 2015. We don't know if this necessarily represents more deaths or just more recorded deaths. There's probably a mixture of the two. Regarding the Mediterranean, there was more than 5,025 deaths during last year that were known about, which was a 35% increase compared to the previous year. In the central Mediterranean, there was a 60% increase recorded migrant deaths compared to the previous year, and a 46% decrease in migrant deaths recorded in the eastern Mediterranean compared to the previous year. Now, what we don't know there is where the border is being pushed back, so where the deaths are happening on land, not necessarily in the sea, but the deaths are happening before people reach the sea. In the Americas, there was a 43% increase in recorded migrant deaths compared with the previous year. It's very likely that that is to do with a higher recording of the deaths. So that paper is available for everyone to find. It's the eighth data briefing we've produced together between... I jointly edit this series with Frank Lasco, who's the head of that centre. It's supported by DFID, that particular set of data briefings. So there's lots of caveats to put on the reporting and the analysis of the data, but I can say we've honestly tried to do a very clear and transparent job on what is known and what isn't known. the work that we're doing on the third Fatal Journeys document will include reports on every region in the world with academics and policymakers, which will probably represent the most in-depth and systematic attempt to do this exercise at a global level. So that's the work of that I've been doing with IOM, and I have to say I was brought into this because I'm an expert in migration statistics, and having worked nearly 30 years in Europe and in the last year in West Africa and Southern Africa with Middle East and North Africa region, I can say that it's not for want of effort that we haven't got a better evidence base. In Europe, perhaps we have the best evidence base of migration statistics of a global region, and it's a proof really that having a better evidence base does not produce better policies, because we have some of the worst policies whilst we have the best evidence. However, we will carry on with this, and one of the projects that I was involved with whilst last year working in Berlin was an ESRC-funded project, which Stephanie's mentioned. There are people in the room here who are also involved in that, Stephanie and Catriona. I think there's anybody else here. Other people, many other people are involved in that. When I presented this last week in Oxford, at the Refugee Studies Centre Conference, I read out the names of every researcher who worked on this project, which was 12 people, and I regard everyone in that project who did the work as being the authors of everything that comes out of this project. On this website, you can see the reports, the official reports of the project. Some of us individually are taking initiatives to write papers, and I'm going to quote from some of the work that one of the papers that's been submitted to the journal Sociology has presented, and that's been drafted and presented by prepared by Simon Robbins, who led this project from the University of York. So doing this work involves a lot of very painful work and a lot of disciplined research activity at qualitative and quantitative levels. The Mediterranean Missing Project was a one-year research project which was funded from September 2015 to October 2016, and it was a collaboration between the University of York, City University and the IOM Centre in Berlin. So I acted as the principal, the co-investigator from Berlin. The project findings have been published in a range of reports, and there's a video, a little podcast video there that has English, Arabic and Italian subtitles. And it focused on three main areas: the impact on families of missing migrants. What was the impact on the families? Something that, as Stephanie said, has not often really has been neglected by academic research and certainly by policymakers. It also focused on law, policy and practice in Sicily in Greece and in Lesbos in Greece and Sicily in Italy, looking at the way in which the local authorities and the national authorities have been managing or not managing the bodies of migrants and what happens there. The research involved interviews with families from five countries, as well as with officials in those two countries. And there were a number of findings which have been listed, set out in a summary report, as well as a short report for Greece and a short report for Italy, and then a long report for each of those countries, and then a report on the findings from the families. I think for the overall outputs of this, I think what I need to say is that the main finding is that the borders of Europe are acting in a way that separates citizens and so-called aliens, citizens and non-citizens. The borders separate people in terms of their rights, whether living or dead. And the borders also, the border does this in a way by killing people. So the borders, put quite bluntly, the borders are causing people to be killed. When we did the short analysis paper that was published last Friday, again, I have to iterate, I do not speak for the IOM, but I advise the IOM. So that report found that the open borders, open land borders in South America were the only place that we found no evidence of deaths of migrants. So I think that can tell you where you've got an open land border and people can cross openly, then people don't tend to die because there's no reason for them to die unless it's for other health reasons. The EU border is resulting in people dying, and we also, as I said, we don't know how many people are dying on land as they travel towards the border. The other findings were that the border actually not only causes this human misery and trauma for the families, but it transmits the trauma, it communicates trauma beyond its own, beyond the geographical area of the European Union. So it communicates trauma to the families left behind, the families who don't know how to get hold of information about, they can't find information about the member of their family who's died. And the border acts to stop communication as well for many, many reasons that families may not want to communicate across that border, but also the states behind the border take no responsibility for what happens to necessarily to, if they take any responsibility for the management of the body, they're not taking responsibility for communicating with the families of the person who's died. So there's a big problem there of recognising what are human rights, but also what is justice in death, what is justice in death, and what is justice for the families left behind who have lost and don't know whether their family member is dead or missing or still alive. So I think the other thing I want to make a point of there, really, that the point that Simon Robbins has been working on a thesis, really, that those families are living in a state of ambiguous loss. It's not possible to know whether you're mourning the death of somebody, whether you're living in hope that that person is still alive. How to manage that process and how to find out what has happened means that families and generation after generation are left in this limbo of not knowing whether to mourn. And that process has a detrimental effect on people's health, mental, physical and psychological health. That doesn't only affect that generation. We see rising levels of suicide and self-harm amongst the families of the left-behind families. But also that trauma is communicated from one generation to the next. And we've seen this, there are evidence in areas of conflict where we've seen in Northern Ireland, there's been evidence through the poverty surveys conducted through Bristol University and others that this type of trauma and physical and mental health effect, which affects the witnesses to tragedies or the people, direct family members who have lost somebody or don't know if they've lost somebody, that physical and mental health effect is transmitted from one, it happens from one generation to the next. So it's these effects are going to have an impact not just on the people alive now, but on their other children, on the coming generations. And it's the racialization of the data and the information that we collect also reflects the way in which the global policies are racialized and in a way are constructing a global order, which means that some people, many people, are not going to have rights for generations to come over this area of knowledge and over finding justice. So what I'm trying to say really is that the empirical evidence that we've found, looking at it with a critical perspective but also trying to understand the numbers, brings us to a way of understanding the gaps in policy, the way in which policies are constructing the borders that cause the deaths, but also they show us where gaps in policy where even with a current situation, states are not fulfilling their responsibilities in international human rights law, and the work that Stephanie and the Last Rights Project, which Catriona is going to speak about, we hope in the question and answers, that there's implications for the way in which justice and law and human rights law can deliver anything that approaches some kind of coherent policy if it's not going to be justice. So I'm sorry, I'll stop there. I could speak all night about this. I hope I've given you an indication of the main points from the research. If you've got any questions in the discussion, we can follow up on that. And I'd encourage everyone to look at these websites because they've got all the information, the empirical information in there. Thank you.
Good evening, everyone. My piece of this is the legal part of it and trying to give some of the legal framework that will help us deal with the phenomenon of the dead in this current migration crisis. It's an area where there is a lack of precision in international human rights law. So if we talk about human rights and the legal position, it would be, of course, desirable to be able to indicate that there are precise provisions, judgments of courts, and so on. But there are not. So we are confronted with a situation where we have to reason by analogy to a certain extent and where we have to be creative. There is an old notion in international law, in the area we call humanitarian law, dealing with armed conflict, that talks about the places where there is a failure to adequately codify the law that applies, and we say that in the absence of more precise rules, that the parties remain bound by the laws of humanity and by the dictates of the public conscience. So it's an interesting idea that reminds us that there's some, even if you get all the books out of the library with all of the treaties and declarations in it, that there's some broader body of law, and I think it's of particular relevance when we're talking about the situation of the dead and the rights of the dead. If we want to go and look for the origins of that and where we might find some indications of what applies, I think that we probably all think intuitively that we understand there are certain rights, certain rules that apply when we're dealing with the dead. I dare say that in some places where dead migrants and asylum seekers have been found, that those who find them feel themselves governed by certain rules and practices, even if there's an absence of precise domestic law or international law that applies. And if we think, you know, of things like think of the Iliad, Homer's Iliad, and way Achilles treats Hector. Do you remember the scene in the Iliad where he slays Hector in the battle and then ties him to the back of his chariot and drags the body around the walls of Troy? And it's clear from Homer, and it certainly plays out later in the Iliad, that Achilles has committed a war crime. It's not said that way. There's no question of taking him to the International Criminal Court or having a special rapporteur do an urgent action on this. This is Greek mythology, but it's something that's part of our heritage that reminds us that there are rules about how we treat the dead. I could point as well to Sophocles' Antigone, where we have the issue about the treatment of the dead and how Antigone defies Creon and insists on giving a proper burial to the fallen warrior, even if the national law has ordered her to ignore it. We could find many other examples. So these are what I'd call the dictates. This is, you know, Homer and Sophocles are kind of reminding us of the dictates of the public conscience. And when we try and apply it to our, what is a very sophisticated body of international law now in the field of human rights, we still find that we don't have precise rules that apply. We have some difficult legal problems that we have to address. The first one is that we generally don't consider the dead to be subjects of international law. We have a variety of rights in instruments like the European Convention on Human Rights, and the European Court of Human Rights has said, although there are exceptions to it, it has said in some of its decisions that once you're dead, you don't have those rights anymore. Those rights don't apply to the dead. So we have a problem of how to address that, how to use our body of human rights to apply to the dead. Now, one approach would be simply to say that, you know, the European Court of Human Rights is not up to date, hasn't given proper consideration to the dictates of the public conscience, and ought to provide a revised interpretation in light of the current situation. And the European Court has done that sometimes in the past, so we can't rule that part out. In other words, to interpret existing human rights law as leaving a place for the treatment of the dead. And I'll say a little more about that in a minute, but I first want to present the problem. The other way of addressing it is to see it as a problem not of the dead, but of the next of kin, the family of the dead, and of their rights. And that's another option, and there's probably more space for that in the existing body of international human rights law, except that there we have a problem too. And it's the fact that the families, by and large, are not in Europe. And so it's difficult to make the European Convention on Human Rights apply. In other words, there's a problem of territorial application or territorial jurisdiction that has to be confronted. So let me give you a few ideas on where solutions lie for some of these problems. The first one, and I think this is, I believe this is an important idea, but I'm often in conflict with colleagues who are a little more obsessed with the black letter law part of international human rights law. And that is that fundamental rights or fundamental human rights are derived first and foremost in our modern system from the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And I don't think the Universal Declaration of Human Rights has a territorial application. Or rather, it applies to the planet. And the obligations that are set out in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, because they're not part of a human rights system in the way something like the European Convention on Human Rights is, those obligations apply flexibly to some extent, but they apply not just to states, by the way, but to all of us. We're bound as individuals by the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It says it in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And so states cannot, I think, just simply shrug their shoulders and say, well, this happened outside of our territory. The European Convention on Human Rights doesn't apply. There's already case law from the European Court of Human Rights saying that in some situations the convention does apply. So the European Court of Human Rights has applied the European Convention to the conduct of British troops in Iraq, for example. And that's clear, and that's the Foreign and Commonwealth Office howled in outrage when this was done by the European Court of Human Rights, but it's become accepted, and I think it's less and less controversial. But it still requires that there be some kind of a control, some kind of exercise by the state for it to apply extraterritorially. But I want to put forward the idea that the United Kingdom and other states, again, this has to be a flexible notion, because it's not as if the United Kingdom is responsible for every human rights violation that happens anywhere on the planet. But that where it's in a position to exercise some role and some control, that it cannot simply hide behind a jurisdictional rule that's established for the European Court of Human Rights and the European Convention on Human Rights, which is a treaty. It's still bound by the laws of humanity, the dictates of the public conscience, and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And so I think this becomes important if we're looking at obligations that might arise, for example, when the dead are found in the high seas. That is not within the territory of a state. So we have the Mediterranean Sea. Part of the Mediterranean Sea is the territory of certain states because they have a maritime territory. They have a territorial sea that extends generally 12 miles from the shore. But there's an area that they don't control, that isn't part of their territory. And yet, I think we have to take the position that there are some obligations that arise there, and that they arise because it's the interface, it's in a way the wall in this issue of migration as people are trying to enter Europe. Again, I'm thinking creatively. I know that if there are other international lawyers in the room, they're going to have technical objections, and there are some, and I'm aware of them. We have to confront them and find ways around them. I think we have very, very strong arguments about the dictates of the public conscience, about the laws of humanity, and what we have to do is inject that into the legal rules and into the black letter law. So how can it apply? How can we address this extraterritorial problem? I've indicated part of it. Part of it, of course, does get addressed because things happen in the territory. So when the dead body of a migrant is found in the territorial sea or on the shore, it's clear that there are obligations that arise there, and some of them are probably being fairly well respected and honored, if only because those who find them, I think it's primarily at the local level, municipalities, villages, do their best to treat the remains of the dead with dignity and treat them appropriately. But there are no rules, and we know that there are places and others where they're not being treated the way they should. Now, in terms of the fundamental rights that might apply, I've mentioned the fact that the families are very important here, and there's a fundamental right to family life, Article 8 of the European Convention on Human Rights, but it's also in the European Union Charter of Fundamental Rights and, moreover, in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So there are rights that belong to the family members, as I said. There's a jurisdictional difficulty, and yet there's also a kind of a jurisdictional link where we need to simply say the fact that the dead body is found in Europe or is brought to Europe creates obligations that relate to the family as a whole, even if the rest of the family isn't here. I think we have to try and argue this and try and insist upon it. And this would have as a consequence some of the rights that we propose in the document that we prepared on guidelines, obligations of notification and perhaps even of repatriation of the remains, which is a more costly and maybe a more radical proposal, but I think we ought to put that on the list of obligations that arise when the dead are found. If we were to say to European governments, well, you have an obligation to notify the family, even that, they might object that this is more work than they're prepared to put into it and more time and energy than they're prepared to invest. But once you've done that and notified the family, to find a poverty-stricken family in Afghanistan or somewhere in Central Africa and say to them, well, here's the body, you can come and get it, you can arrange to have it repatriated when the cost is prohibitive, means that the fundamental rights associated with the treatment of the dead and with the family issues, the family life issues that arise, would not be fully respected. So we have to push for this to be the case. I think that we can also argue that the right to life itself, which is the core human right, Article 2 of the European Convention on Human Rights, Article 3 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, it's in all the treaties, and it sounds almost paradoxical to talk about the rights of the dead when within the framework of the right to life, because that seems like that's a right that belongs to the living. But I think that one can also argue that the reason why we treat the dead with dignity and why we insist on this is because of the right to life. It's because they were human beings and they were living human beings, and that's why we treat their remains with respect. I think there's an argument. There are probably thinkers who are more imaginative than I am who will think out more eloquent ways to express this. But I do believe that there's a way forward in terms of relating this obligation also to the right to life. We did some work on trying to figure out what these obligations might consist of, obligations to find the bodies. This is important. It's one thing when they arrive on the shore, but it's another thing when they're lost at sea, and I think probably, I don't know how they did the count there, maybe these are all just bodies that were actually found and identified. There are clear obligations under international law that are probably ancient in origin, but that have even been codified in various treaties that require ships, when they find people in distress in the high seas, to assist them. And to, if you see a lifeboat with three people starving to death in the lifeboat, there's an obligation on a ship to provide assistance to the people in the lifeboat, and that would seem obvious enough to us anyway and not really controversial. It certainly fits within the dictates of the public conscience and the laws of humanity. But what about the dead? What about if you see a lifeboat where there's just dead bodies in there? Is there an obligation there? And I think this is it's a more difficult case to make, but one under the circumstances here that we have to try and develop. So this is important because this will extend the obligations beyond the territorial sea, it seems to me. And this has to be related to the fact that the migration crisis, if I can use that word, is of Europe's making because its borders have been closed. And the people who are dying are doing nothing more than exercising fundamental rights that are in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The Refugee Convention does not create an obligation on states to bring refugees into the country. But it is, in fact, an attempt to give some substance in the treaty to a more broadly formulated right in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is the right of everyone to seek and enjoy asylum from persecution. And those who are dying in the Mediterranean Sea are people who are exercising that right to seek and enjoy asylum from persecution. And by closing the border, we are preventing them from exercising that right. And so I think there's a link there, an important one, that also can be developed in the legal arguments for saying that the European states have obligations not only to, with regard to the treatment of bodies that they find on the shore or in their territorial waters, but to go and look for them in the high seas. And when they find them, to see that they're treated properly. Now, we used as a kind of a basis for trying to develop what these rules might be some guidance that we borrowed from the law of armed conflict, from international humanitarian law. I want to be quite precise about this and very careful in saying it, because this is not really an international humanitarian law issue. There is a tendency among some constituencies in the human rights field to overemphasize the role of the law of armed conflict, of international humanitarian law. Most of the migrants it's not armed conflict, although armed conflict may be at the origin, certainly those from the Middle East, but not so much, although to some extent, those from Africa. But we have to de-link it. These are not obligations. First of all, the issue of dealing with the dead and the law of armed conflict is essentially about the dead on the battlefield. And we're not on the battlefield. We're somewhere else. So we've used that law, which developed, again, more than a century ago, about how to treat the dead found on the battlefield, to take some of the language, some of the formulations, and some of the rights about identification of the bodies, about their treatment, about repatriation, about communicating with the families, to use some of that language in formulating a list of guidelines that you know, we're proposing. It's far too early to talk about a treaty, and maybe there'll never be a treaty. Maybe we have too many treaties in the area of human rights anyway. But perhaps guidelines are enough to say to states, this is what you have to do. Not just to states, but again, I think probably a lot of this, you know, happens at the level of municipalities, who are having to deal with these problems. They find a body on the beach and they have to look after it, and they don't go running to the central government, to the ministry, saying, tell us what to do. It's what ordinary people do. It's like Eleanor Roosevelt famously said that human rights begin in small places close to home. And so I think that guidelines would be very helpful there as well, but they need to be reinforced and energized with the idea that these are in the exercise of fundamental rights, and I've given some of the sources. I think that's maybe enough for, by way of legal introduction to some of the problems and some of the potential solutions.
I'm going now to read Claire Moon's paper on the human rights of the dead. Claire is the author, So when I say I, it means that Claire's speaking. The questions I'm going to and I'm going to read this because it's Claire's text. The questions I'm going to address are, do the dead have human rights? And if so, what specific rights might they have? Now, this is a hugely controversial question that invites widely varying responses. I've put it to a range of professionals and experts, particularly international lawyers and forensic scientists who work on human rights issues by identifying the dead and returning them to families. And I've been faced with radically polarized responses to that question, ranging from, what a ridiculous question. Of course the dead don't have rights. Only the living have rights. To, on the other hand, what a ridiculous question. Of course the dead have human rights. There's clearly something to be sorted out here, and I'd suggest, following Marcel Mauss, that it's usually in these ill-demarcated domains that the urgent problems lie. And there's no question that this is an urgent issue. I strongly think we need to begin the process of articulating something that, I think, is on the brink of being spoken. That is, the human rights of the dead is begging now to be established. What I'm going to do in this talk is to put forward some provisional lines of inquiry and no clear answer to this question at this point in time. I'm currently working on this and haven't reached firm conclusions yet. What I will do is present some key resources and evidence and sketch out how these might be taken forward. I should also preface my talk by saying that my thinking on this issue comes from outside the European context. I've looked at Latin American cases, principally Argentina and Mexico, and at first, the forensic identification of mass dead victims of atrocities, such as torture and enforced disappearances, and secondly, at the use of forensics to address humanitarian issues, such as the suffering of the families of the dead. So, in what follows, I'm going to state my argument, evidence it with reference to history, law, and forensics, and make some suggestions regarding what rights might be developed with respect to the dead. My argument is as follows. Attempts to establish the human rights of the dead have generated mainly philosophical interest so far, but they have also eluded such justification. As I see it, this is partly because the dead have no interests. So how can they possibly benefit from rights? I'd suggest that we get further with the argument by exploring it empirically instead. That would mean that we can assert that the dead have human rights insofar as people act as though they have rights. That's to say, whether it codes conventions and social practices that confer rights and human rights upon the dead, then the claim can be sustained. After all, human rights is as much a practical activity as it is one of principle. We can argue that human rights exist in the world insofar as people behave in accordance and can be observed to behave in accordance with the principles it sets out. This means, following Durkheim, understanding human rights as social facts, values and norms that shape and constrain human action that can, at some level, be observed and documented. An immediate and obvious problem now arises. The dead cannot be rights claimers, and neither can they be bearers of responsibilities. But, I would argue, they can be seen to be rights holders insofar as the living behave as if they have obligations towards the dead, treat them as if they have rights, and confer the rights upon them in practice. As a result, it's necessary to inquire into the history, protocols, and practices on which this activity is built, and the existing principles that confer rights upon the dead. So let's now turn to look at these. Here's some historical evidence. It's my view that the dead were absolutely central to the birth of both modern humanitarianism and human rights. On humanitarianism, I'd start with Henri Dunant's famous commentary on battlefield suffering in 1862, The Memory of Solferino. His text was fundamental to the founding of the most well-known humanitarian agency, the Red Cross, which initiated legal and ethical codes for the treatment of war dead. So there's no question in my mind that the dead were at the heart of the appearance of modern humanitarianism. On human rights, I'd argue that when the Universal Declaration of Human Rights appeared in 1948, it was both animated and haunted by the figure of 6 million dead. The Universal Declaration was partly an attempt to reconstruct moral meaning in the wake of terror of so many killed. It seemed to ask, for what did they die? So I see the Universal Declaration as in part as an expression of what we owe to the dead. It's a promise to them. This promise was later invigorated by the human rights slogan, Nunca Más, never again, in the context of Latin American atrocities perpetrated by the state against its citizens from the 1970s to the 1990s, Argentina and Chile are notable, and various proxy wars and state terror in Central America between the 1960s and 1990s. Here the examples are Guatemala, Nicaragua, and El Salvador. In the latter part of the 20th century, the dead body was turned into what Lacour calls an articulate witness to atrocity. This practice started famously in the mid-1980s when forensic anthropologists who specialize in the analysis of skeletonized human remains made the dead body attest to the terrors of the Argentine military junta. From this point on, forensic science was put explicitly into the service of human rights inquiries by making the dead speak the truth of atrocity. It also came to pursue humanitarian objectives by exhuming and identifying human remains and returning them to relatives as a way of addressing family trauma and suffering. The ethics of what I call forensic humanitarianism have since traveled and spread widely through an epistemic community of forensic entrepreneurs to diverse sites such as Spain, Bosnia, Cambodia, and Rwanda. Forensic techniques are now a firm fixture of new humanitarian rationalities and practices. Now, turning to the law, the evidence of legal principles relating to the dead is historic, abundant, and absolutely central to humanitarian activity. International humanitarian law provides legally binding rules that regulate the treatment of the dead, especially the search for collection, treatment, return, disposal, and identification of the dead, principally in the context of armed conflict. These rules have a distinguished and established lineage. They're derived from the 1907 Hague Convention, the 1929 and 1949 Geneva Conventions and additional protocols of 1977, and the Statute of the International Criminal Court, which came into force in 2002. Strikingly, they apply the same obligations to the dead as to certain categories of the living. For example, the obligation to search for and collect the wounded, sick, and shipwrecked also extends to the dead. This obligation is claimed to derive from the principle of respect for every dead. Specifically, and I'm quoting from international humanitarian law here, first, the prohibition against despoiling or mutilating the dead is covered by the war crime of committing outrages upon personal dignity. Second, the practice of returning the dead and their personal effects is in keeping with the requirement of respect for family life. International humanitarian law articulates the dead as family members, and their right treatment overlaps with the respect for family life. Thirdly, international humanitarian law stipulates that the dead must be disposed of in a respectful manner and their graves respected and properly maintained. This rule reflects a general principle of law requiring respect for the dead and their graves. There's some interesting detail here, including requirements that the dead be buried according to rites prescribed by their religion, that they may be cremated only in exceptional circumstances, that they must be buried in individual and not collective graves, and that war graves be grouped according to nationality where possible. These stipulations imply a respect for the customs and beliefs of the dead held in life, for the beliefs and customs of the living members of the communities from which the dead person came, and for the identities of the dead. Finally, humanitarian law stipulates that the dead must be identified prior to their disposal. Identification is also central to Interpol's 1996 General Assembly Statement on Disaster Victim Identification, but it's here expressed by Interpol as a right. It states that human beings have the right not to lose their identities after death. There is plenty here, I'd suggest, that might and should be extended beyond the context of armed conflict and disaster identification to address dead migrants at Europe's borders. Particularly relevant are issues of identification, return to families, and proper burial. I'll come back to these. Now, forensics. There is further empirical evidence of the rights of the dead in the forensics field. The Red Cross sets out the protocols for forensic recovery and identification of the dead, covering ante-mortem data collection, the treatment of graves, exhumation and autopsy protocols, the recording of post-mortem data, and the identification of human remains. These protocols emphasize the need to treat the dead with dignity. They state that at all times, forensic practice must respect the dignity, honor, reputation, and privacy of the dead. I want to single out the practice of identification of the dead person here. Identification, as I see it, is a practice that reunites the dead body with their identity in life. It restores personhood after death. And in cases where the dead have been violently and radically dehumanized through dismemberment, either prior to or after death, as is too often the case currently in Mexico. Forensic identification is also a practice of rehumanization after death, a process of reassembling the person, both physically and sometimes in terms of uniting the dead body with their identity. Forensic work thus speaks to what Mary Douglas calls matter out of place, insofar as it reinstalls the dead back into the social order by establishing identity and kinship and facilitating burial rites. Now to turn to principles. There are a couple of central principles that recur throughout these histories, legal codes, and forensic practices. Respect and dignity appear time after time. They underpin, shape, and dominate the protocols governing humanitarian treatment of the dead. These principles tell us something about the social importance of the dead and are reflections of widespread social norms, older and more persuasive than those ushered in by law and forensics. The principle of dignity is of particular interest to us insofar as it is absolutely central to the idea of the human that is elaborated in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The Universal Declaration recognizes, that is, constitutes, the inherent dignity of all members of the human family. It is the core concept of human rights, and it is the single principle that defines what it is to be human. Legal protocols and forensic practice require that the dead are treated as if they have the right to dignity, and they require that the living act in ways that are concordant with this belief. To conclude, it would be a nonsense to suggest that the dead can be fully and comprehensively invested with human rights. Most, if not virtually all, human rights are entirely irrelevant to the dead. However, we can argue that the dead, within existing principles, legal codes, and forensic practice, are understood and treated as if they have at least one residual human right, the right to be treated with dignity. I use the word residual here deliberately in reference to two things. The dead body is what is left over or is remaining of the human in life, and what remains of human rights after death. And my final point is to say that the work we need to do in order to push this debate further is to explore specifically what goods the dead might have a right to, and whether they have a valid claim on society to protect their possession of them. Finally, I'd suggest that we already have evidence for three specific rights that could be claimed and consolidated. These are rights that are implicit in the existing histories, regulations, and practices, and recur time and again. These are rights to dignity, return to family, and to burial rights. I'd argue that these are distinctively human rights, but human rights that act in an entirely rehabilitative way. That is, they work to compensate for rights that have been dramatically stripped away in life, such as, in the cases I've worked on, the rights to life and security, freedom from torture and inhuman treatment, the right to personhood, and the right to equal protection under the law. Thank you. We've now got, I think, about half an hour of podcast time for discussion, and I think we have a lot to discuss. To start us off, and perhaps speak in a way which looks to the future, I'd like to invite Catriona Jarvis to come and speak here into the microphone. Catriona was formerly a UK immigration judge. Yes.
Good evening, everybody. Thank you very much, Stephanie, and thank you to all the speakers so far. I'm just going to take a few minutes now because I'm very well aware there are lots of other people who I'm sure have got things they want to comment on or questions to ask. Looking to the future, as Stephanie said, I want to tell you about Mathoria, which is a small not-for-profit legal and policy entity founded in 2015. It's myself, a human rights lawyer, children's human rights lawyer, Sid Bolton. Stephanie is our legal advisor, and we have a young Greek lawyer also working with us. Briefly, the project, which is called Last Rights, will address legal gaps and failures, aim to develop international best practice and procedure for working with dead, missing migrants and bereaved families to ensure that their rights are respected. This will take the form of an overarching protocol setting out relevant international law, followed by best practice and procedure, and we'll base ourselves in international human rights law, but drawing on humanitarian law, as has been mentioned already by Bill and by Claire through Stephanie. And a commentary will accompany that for those who may find those sorts of things interesting. We had in our minds as our initial idea the Istanbul Protocol, which some of you may be familiar with, as a sort of precedent. It started its life very much as a grassroots upwards project and was eventually adopted by the UN in 1999. It's intended that our protocol and guidance should improve access to justice for many thousands globally, a high number of whom will be women and children who may have had to become heads of household following loss in the course of a migrant journey. There are different strands of beneficiaries, but the main groups are the bereaved family members of missing and dead migrants and all those working with these groups, such as Coast Guard, police, Red Cross societies, clinicians, lawyers and judges, civil servants and advocates and so on. Local communities where migrants go missing and where the dead are found will likewise benefit from respectful lawful treatment of missing and the dead and their families. But it's also in the interests of states to deal effectively and humanely with these difficult issues whilst respecting human rights. The proposed protocol and guidance, and this is an important aspect of it, will be adoptable, usable, without any need to change laws nationally or internationally, or wait for that formal adoption, should it ever come by the EU or by the UN. As Bill has said, we need to be creative in our approach to this. So work on that first draft of the guidance, plus the draft consultation has just begun, and the idea is to have eventually an electronic consultation form that we can upload to our website, which has fairly recently been set up, so that it can be widely disseminated. And simultaneously, we'll form a suitable reference group, and it has already the Greek Forum of Refugees, the International Committee of the Red Cross, Médecins Sans Frontières, other human rights centres, refugee representatives, forensic experts, police and others. So we'll conduct a review of the law. A start has been made, as we've heard, with a main focus on European law. But we, in the Last Rights Project, want to look more widely to cover some of the areas that Stephanie mentioned in her initial introduction in other parts of the world. We have some reports from the Last Rights meeting in April 2016 that was held at LSE, and they're already on the Last Rights website. We plan, following the consultation, to hold a two-day conference on Lesbos, where we hope we will discuss and finally agree the documents that I've talked about. The project aims to ensure the rights of thousands of bereaved family members, including orphan children, as well as the rights of missing and dead migrants in some of the ways that we've been talking about, not least in family tracing, dignified burial in a known grave, exhumation and repatriation where relevant, and the possibility to grieve and obtain closure, and also, importantly, to support all those who are working with these groups on a daily basis, including those on the front line, particularly the Coast Guard, clinicians and forensic experts. And our hope is that this work will transform research and legal principles into deliverable and real benefits and respect for human rights of people. I think I did mention that, but yes, absolutely. Yes. Absolutely.
Finally, before we open the general discussion, I'd like to invite another visiting fellow at the LSE Center for the Study of Human Rights, Eyüp Gilazgi, to say something as a kind of response from his perspective to what he's heard this evening. Eyüp is secretary of PEN, Poets, Essayists. I never remember what it is. Poets, Essayists and Novelists, is that right? Eritrea in Exile. And he's with the English PEN at the moment. And you're also the founder of African Monitors in Uganda. There you go.
Thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to reflect on the presentation of the speakers. It is very interesting theme because me, I am a refugee and I am really very much touched by this issue of migration and disappearance and deaths. I myself lost a sister in 2002. And we didn't have any information about her. The information we had was that she was in Libya in 2002. Then we didn't get any information. And my family, particularly my mother, was very much affected. And in our society, there is a saying that knowing about the loss is as if you have it, as if you have not lost it. But to lose someone but you don't know about the fate is something very terrible. So the family could not move on, and then we, after asking many people, we got the information that the boat she sailed on from Libya, just it is part of the wreck of the boat was found on the shores of Italy. So that we concluded that she had died. And there was another person with her that we know. On the presentation, I really appreciate that they touched everything. Even I didn't think that I would not take note of. So it was great. But I want to stress one thing, which, okay, the right of the dead in terms of getting dignified burial, all these things are very important, and you touched it. But the family, as you also highlighted it, is really, families are suffering from this issue, and the legality, which prevents families from, like, we did a research in Uganda, and I want to read the quote from the research. We found that she lost her husband in Lampedusa, and the question we asked was, why did you leave Eritrea? And she said, my husband is one of the Lampedusa victims who died in the Mediterranean Sea. He crossed the Mediterranean Sea from Libya by boat, and died in October 2013. This was a very hot issue in October 2013 in Lampedusa, Italy. He left Eritrea because he was suffering under the National Service Program. He could not tolerate it anymore. He could not work, and he could not assist me. That is why he left. And after he left, I could not do anything. When I found out he died, I wanted to visit to the location where his body rested. I wanted to go to see my husband's resting place, to see the body, the burial place. That is why I left Eritrea. Life was bad for me. I had no job in Eritrea, and I had a one-year-old baby by that time in 2003. My expectation was to get asylum and then full status as a refugee, and I had a plan to see my husband's grave. I had applied to the Italian embassy in Eritrea and the German embassy here in Kampala, but I didn't get the chance. I can work and do something, but I don't have the chance here. There is no job. If I get a job, I can work and pay for my children. But my main issue is to see the grave of my husband and to tell the children. They should have the right to know where their father is. And the real issue is that I want to see my husband's body. His plan was to get a safe place for his children and to get them good education. So I want to follow through on this plan. First of all, I want to see the grave of my husband, and I want to tell my children that their father is dead. Still they are asking me, where is he? When is he coming back? I haven't told them because they are children, and if I see the grave, I can tell or explain to them. The government of Italy gave me a death certificate, but they refused to let me go and see the grave. They should have to take my children to a safe place, but they don't. Sometimes I get money and then I send my kids to school, but if I don't get money, I keep them at home. I cannot pay continuously. I cannot sometimes pay for them for the term, and then I have to stop. Then she cries. Thank you.
We have now a little time for general discussion, and I think we have a roving mic. Well, it can rove.
Yes, it can.
So, comments, questions, Fran Weber from the Institute of Race Relations.
Thank you. Okay, a couple of things. It seems to us, following on from the groundbreaking work of Leanne Weber and Sharon Pickering, who've written about deaths at the global frontier, that it's incredibly important to identify the dead. Weber and Pickering talked about accounting for the dead in two different ways. One was giving them their name back, giving them their name, their story back. And the other one was accountability, making the governments whose policies cause these deaths accountable for them. So we at the Institute of Race Relations have been working on this for some time and trying to account for deaths at the borders. We've actually brought along today a few copies of some recent articles about deaths in Greece and about deaths at the Serbian-Hungarian border. One of the things that we have come up against in researching those articles has been it's been very, very difficult to get information from people who have the information. So, for example, UNHCR, in their daily digest, talked about, I think it was three people, wasn't it? Three people who had died in Serbia. So we wrote to them and said, can you give us some details? Can you give us some names, some identifiers? They said no, they wouldn't, because it was against their internal confidentiality guidelines. And this raises a really important issue, I think, which needs to be discussed. Obviously, if somebody is subject to a violent death or an accidental death under normal circumstances, the authorities would wait to notify the family before publicising that information. And you can understand absolutely the reasons for that. But in the case of migrants who are dying in very remote places, very often in near border zones, maybe in forests or in snow or whatever, and we've heard about how difficult it is for families to get to know, to find out what's happened to their loved ones. So the question is, we also know that authorities, officials, use the privacy argument to prevent sort of public knowledge of deaths for which they themselves may be held accountable. So it seems to me there's a really important sort of conflict of interest here in terms of identifying the dead, which we need to maybe discuss, and certainly we are trying to address the UNHCR's attitude and challenge that in the particular context of migrant deaths, and saying that the criteria that normally apply wouldn't apply here. But I'd be very interested to hear what other people think about that issue. Anyway, if anyone wants, we've got these articles here, but you can also download them from the IRR website.
I'm Bronwyn Manby. I'm also another visiting fellow at the Centre for the Study of Human Rights. I have a question. Some of the work that I do relates to legal identity and statelessness, and I am interested in your thoughts about the possibility of exploring the advocacy through the Sustainable Development Goals, which initially sounds like a very unpromising route. However, target 16.9 of the under goal 16 of the Sustainable Development Goals, goal 16 is the one about justice and good governance and all of that, conflict, those things. Goal 16 says provide legal identity for all, including birth registration. I'm wondering about, now everybody knows what birth registration means, and nobody knows what legal identity means. There's a complete confusion over what that means. There is, however, quite a lot of investment going into birth registration, but birth registration without a more complete civil registration system can be a little bit meaningless. But I'm wondering about placing an obligation on death registration within that complex of activities might be a useful avenue if one's looking at rather major investments that are being made in civil registration systems, not only about birth registration, and whether one might go down that route, which would apply not only to this context of missing migrants, but in many countries, even where there's a push on birth registration, the death registration isn't covered. And it doesn't only impact on the dead and their dignity, it also impacts on the ability to inherit, the ability to pass nationality to children, a lot of other rights which are about the living and therefore about development in the context of the Sustainable Development Goals. So it's just thinking about the question and partly a suggestion, I guess, about whether you've engaged with that discussion. And then I just have a question about have these principles been discussed with any government representatives, the European Union, the Council of Europe? What do they think about it?
My question is about the same issue I was quoting. Like in this case, I was wondering if, like in this case, this woman wants to see the grave of her husband, but the issue of legality comes that she's unable to travel. And in this case, her husband is there, and she is out of Eritrea. Even if we think then we say, let's say, the body should return to Eritrea, but she is not in Eritrea. She is a refugee in Uganda. So in such circumstances, what kind of legality are there to support this woman or any other case similar to this?
Oh, would you like it?
We've had three questions and thought sets of thoughts, and I wondered whether, Bill, you have any response. I think particularly maybe on Bronwyn's point about death registration and in comparison with, or in contrast to birth registration, and also I wondered whether Anne, you would have a comment. Start with Bill.
On the issue of the death registration, we certainly have addressed that for the reasons you've mentioned, and it's important. Again, for the family, there are a variety of legal issues that flow from that, and so it's very important that that be part of it. This is one of the important reasons for identifying the bodies, but then providing some legal confirmation of the death. So that is a matter that, again, is also addressed, of course, and it's part of international humanitarian law, of the norms that they have for dealing with the dead. On the issue of the woman you referred to in Uganda, I have to confess we didn't really give any thought to that. I think the obstacle there is legal to her being able, for legal reasons, to travel. It's not that she's physically unable to travel, it's the Italians won't let her into Italy. Isn't that correct? Yeah. Well, it's an issue that we did not confront, and we might think about discussing that case. I don't know if it's, you know, it's probably not a widespread situation in the way that some of the others are, but it's something that would have to be addressed, and so I think we should take that up and mention it.
I think ironically that the International Organization of Civil Aviation and I think some part of European Union regulations provides a duty on airlines to make it possible for relatives of those lost in crashes to come for humanitarian purposes to the site of the crash. Again, another example of the contrast between the normal practice in terms of humanitarian disasters and the exceptional way in which these tragedies are treated.
But that's, Stephanie, that's the airline's obligation to facilitate that. It doesn't solve the problem of the country. If you had a crash of an airplane from Afghanistan or Eritrea, the airlines might say, you know, we're prepared to fly the families in. And the European governments might still say, well, but they don't, we're not going to give them a visa. I think that's really the...
Yeah, I'd like to come back on two or three of the points. One on the issue of the UNHCR and naming people and not releasing information about individuals. I think that there could be a number of reasons for that, and one obviously could be for whichever reason that you've identified that you know you're after why that's happening. There's another reason, I think, as well, and it's not to excuse what's happening, but whenever I've come across the problems with data and states not wanting and organisations not wanting to release data, very often there's a huge issue about the reliability of the information and the quality of data, and it's about embarrassment, about not actually knowing what they've got. So have they really got identified people, or has somebody given them information and not sure whether it's actually true or not? So there's a whole issue there about quality of data. I think for one of the things I wanted to say on that was it's thought that between a third and a half of the deaths are probably children or unaccompanied minors or people under the age of 18, but children in law. On the central Mediterranean route, it's very likely that that's the case. And the reason we don't have the numbers is because the bodies don't survive and the children, the bodies disappear. So that's another of the gruesome realities of this, that we don't know how many tens of thousands of bodies there are in the sea and how many of those are children. And I think that brings me also to the funeral rituals side, the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child and the importance of a funeral rite for... societal relations. So you have the situation for, there's a whole gendered thing here for women who are widows who are not acknowledged as being widows and cannot inherit. There's all of that issue. Then there's the children who the parents can't mourn because they don't have that information. So that has impacts on the way that the communities, these funeral rituals reproduce societal relations. And if there's a rupture there, then there's a rupture to the societal relations, which is very often a destructive one. And I think on the, the ID is not just about, identification is not just about documents, but I think this point about the SDGs, I think, is a really, really important one. And civil registration, I think the death registration, putting a duty for that would be a very, very good step to take. Another final point would be, it is possible for states to issue temporary visas for travel to say, this is a special visa to allow you to come for the purposes of identifying your family member for 3-6 months or however long they deem possible. It's quite possible for states to do that. It doesn't seem to me a very unreasonable request or demand for us to be making.
Yes, let's have one more round of comments and questions.
The challenge is that this is a refugee herself and many others are refugees, so the Italian government is refusing visa on the assumption that she may not return. So this is the case, and they are making assumption that they are still, this is a protection mechanism, not allowing refugees. That is how I see it.
Sorry, thank you. Yes, I was just saying, I think that one of the things we must demand as part of our work is an established humanitarian visa regime for all family members who find themselves in these dreadful situations.
I just want to give a quick plug, because she's too modest to do it herself, to Katriona's piece called In Potter's Fields, which you will find on the internet, on the State Watch site, I think. It's a very moving piece, and it talks about this contrast with the way that the migrant dead are treated and the way that others, settler, I don't know what to call them, just other human beings are treated like victims of humanitarian disasters, and it is absolutely shocking when you think about it. So I just wanted to give that a plug, and for those of you who haven't read it already, because it is really powerful. Sorry.
Well, it's actually a question to Mr. Bill. Don't remember your surname, sorry. When you were talking about ways that we should find ways as international lawyers to overcome the impediments in substantiating the rights of the dead, well, apart from the fact that the right of the dead not to be despoiled is embedded in the Geneva Conventions, and it has attained the status of customary international law, as Ms. Grant said while reading Ms. Claire Moon's article. I was thinking, it occurred to me, so it's a genuine question, if we could perhaps use the method of analogy in order to transfer the provisions of the Geneva Conventions concerning the rights of the dead to circumstances of the deaths of the immigrant, because it is a case that the legislator has failed to prescribe for, and of course the method of analogy in law says that we must regulate, we must implement it where there are substantial similarities. But we could, we could say that in both cases death occur in a humanitarian crisis context. So, I'm just asking if that would be a further way to reinforce the argument that you were trying to make. So, thank you. Yeah.
Do you want to take the same question? Yeah.
Thank you. I was wondering whether the UN Working Group on Enforced Disappearances might be charged with this problem. I mean, I was so struck by the descriptions of the agony of people, families who simply do not know what happened. And it's so much an issue when it comes to enforced disappearances.
Well, both of these last two comments have focused our attention on areas of international law that are reasonably well regulated, and that are kind of on the periphery of this problem of the dead in the context of migration. The question of the enforced disappearance part of it, of course, as you say, it's addressed more to the families, who are the victims of the enforced disappearance, and in that case, that body of law is helpful to us. With the international humanitarian law, the Geneva Conventions, and other relevant documents, we have used that a lot for inspiration, and as you said, reasoning by analogy. Again, the problem is that the international humanitarian law, the Geneva Conventions deal with. You've got a battlefield. You know where the dead are. You've identified them. And so the obligations, you know, we have the example of Henri Dunant at the Battle of Solferino, and he sees all the dead and the dying on the battlefield and says we have to do things for them. And, of course, so that is fairly well regulated. But the problem of migrants goes beyond that, because there is an obligation. There has to be an obligation to go out and search out the dead themselves. And there are the questions then of the family who will be outside the jurisdiction. That's the other part of it. In the case of enforced disappearance, we'll deal with the family as victims to the extent that they're within the jurisdiction. But our problem here is that the families are often very far away. And there, again, we've talked about some of these obligations. One new one that I think had not really occurred to us, we've already mentioned, is the ability to travel of those who want to see the gravesite when it's there. And I think the point is quite right. The idea of giving a humanitarian visa is fine, except that European states are afraid that someone's going to land and then they're going to say, and by the way, I'd rather be a refugee in Italy than in Uganda, and so I'm going to also make my claim, and that's the law says that they have a right to do that. There's no Dublin agreement with Uganda where we'd send them back and say that's where they first made their claim, I don't think. So these are, of course, it is. These are some of the problems, and we do and need to continue to sort of draw on the principles and the ideas that have been developed in the context of the law of enforced disappearance, where we have a working group, we have a treaty, we have a committee, and the humanitarian law, where we have, you know, an elaborate system that has developed over 150 years. I think if you die on the battlefield, I mean, it's not a nice end, but you're well looked after in a way by law. You are, thanks to Henri Dunant and the Red Cross and everything. But here, not really. And I think that in some cases, actually, there are probably examples of people trying to do the right thing. I think some of those Greek villages behave very nobly and honorably in trying to do it. But some of the issues they have to confront go well beyond their own means of contacting families. And, of course, there's not a Greek island or a village that's going to be able to give a visa to someone to come and or to arrange to finance the repatriation of the remains as well.
Just a last word to
thank you. I think one example that we can see where human beings and humanitarian rescue organisations have filled a gap is where we saw the suspension of the Mare Nostrum operations in the Mediterranean and then the introduction of Triton 1 and then Triton 2. And if you look at where the gaps were filled, states do not have a conscience. It's human beings who have humanitarian responses, who respond to the needs of human beings. And what we've seen on the Greek beaches and in Italy and in the boats rescuing people in the Mediterranean, that gap that was left by the states not meeting their obligations has been met, obviously not completely, but to a great extent, by NGOs and human beings. And I think that's the only way we've got any hope in this world, is to call our governments to account, because and to demand that this is dealt with and that we also take action, because the implications for Europe of not addressing this are that the quality of our so-called society here, the quality of our social quality, is compromised. Our civil liberties are compromised by not protecting the rights and the civil liberties of the most vulnerable people. And so even if we address it from that point of view, what kind of a world do we all want to live in? We can't live in a Europe that's safe away from all of these problems. And I think that's where the hope lies, in having the vision to see that's what we have to address. And as much as law can help us, that's only one thing in our armoury to address this problem.
Thank you. We've come to the end of our time and we've come to the end of this panel, but I think we've also come to the beginning of a long and difficult but supremely important process to take forward some of the ideas that have been expressed here and to turn those into practical and effective action on behalf of the people who have absolutely no voice, of course the dead, but also, of course, the families of the missing. Thank you very, very much, Bill, Ayo, Cacciona, and everybody who's been here and contributed to the discussion. I think it's been a very, very interesting event.